Please be seated. Well, good morning. They tell us it's going to snow tonight. I don't think I'm quite ready for it, but whether ready or not, it decides to come. That's Wisconsin. You will note that Justice Brian Hagedorn is not on the bench this morning. We will sit six on the case. Let's see here. Okay, Chomsky versus Germantown School District. Are you ready to proceed, counsel?
Dear Chief Justice.
Please do.
Chief Justice, Justices of the Court, if it please the Court, I am Kirk Strang, and my co-counsel is Ben Rousseau. We are both of the law firm of Strang, Pattison, Renning, Lewis, and Lacey. We represent the Germantown School District and the Germantown Board of Education in this case. Presents one unavoidable, indisputable fact that makes all the difference. It provides context for the body of facts that the parties of the court and indeed under the court's precedent. Plaintiffs filed a class action lawsuit in Merritt's case, and the Germantown School District tendered the class action case to its insurers for an adjudication of its coverage defense obligations. The insurers responded less than a month later, denying both coverage and denying a defense to the district. The denial was unambiguous and complete. The insurer stated, quote, it has no obligation to defend or potentially indemnify the Germantown School District and or the Board of Education against the claims asserted in the lawsuit. This irrefutable fact should be the linchpin for any number of conclusions, both factual and legal.
Counsel, I understand that between July 16, 2013 and November 30th, 2013, the district was billed by Bulow Vedder something in excess of $80,000 for services. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Did all of that address Merritt's defense, or did any of that address coverage?
That addressed Merritt's defense only.
So what was happening during that period of time that racked up $80,000 in bills?
In this case, it was a class action lawsuit which provided almost immediately. There also were dispositive motions filed, and there was an interlocutory appeal brought within the first year of the case by that law firm.
And did that happen, that interlocutory appeal, did that happen prior to November 30th?
It did not. It happened during the first year in which the insurer acknowledged an obligation to defend in a brief supporting a motion for summary judgment, roughly 6 months after the lawsuit had been filed, and roughly 12 months after the lawsuit had been filed, the insurer actually completed a contract with Bulow Vedder and began paying Bulow Vedder directly for defense.
Okay, so so the insurers did not actually start providing for the defense until approximately a year after the complaint was filed?
In our understanding of what the court means by providing a defense, that is correct, Justice. Payment for their services directly did not commence until the contract was consummated.
Okay. And what date was that the insurance company started actually paying?
The precise date, I believe it began in May of 2014.
So up to that point, the district was...
That is correct. The fact that I was alluding to earlier prior to the Justice's question, in our view, makes for the following conclusions. First, that the insurers elected to unilaterally deny both coverage and a defense, and for that reason, within this court's precedent, they did so at their peril. Secondly, in terms of the arguments being submitted to this court in this case, the insurer's arguments almost universally ignore this pivotal aspect of the case to the point that it almost appears as though this never happened. The failure to acknowledge this fact, however, won't wish it away. All of the arguments made by opposing party are arguments that don't account for the fact that initially both coverage and defense were uniformly denied. And for that reason, our distinguished opposing counsel's citation to authority candidly misses an essential element of the analysis.
So would you have us find, counsel, that the fact that they denied coverage, even though they were asking for a stay, they were responsible in the meantime to, they had a duty to defend that they breached during that, at least until they later on said that they would, in fact,
That is correct. That is to say, if the insurer begins the process by denying both defense and coverage, that sets us down a particular path where the insurer is at its peril for failing to provide that defense in circumstances where a defense should be provided.
So the better, so what you're saying is the course of action that would protect them from a breach would be to file a motion for stay, but while that motion is pending, to reserve rights and go ahead and defend.
That's correct. And indeed, Justice Bradley's, well, unfortunately, this Justice Bradley's opinion in the Waterwell case is an example of why that is the case. That is to say, the court has contrasted in its majority opinions choosing to deny coverage with a series of other judicially preferred options. It is not as though one can do both at the same time, deny coverage and then say, we are filing a motion to stay and motion to bifurcate, because that motion all by itself does nothing in terms of the insured's right to coverage or defense.
Well, doesn't it do something in terms of the insured's right to coverage, but perhaps not defense in your argument?
It doesn't, Justice Bradley, on grounds that the duty to defend is broader than
yes,
the duty to
defend. That's why I slice and dice your response, because it implicates coverage. You know, the circuit court can say yay or nay, your decision was right or wrong, but as I understand your argument, the duty to defend, which is broader, commences prior to the determination. Let me push you on this a little bit. We have lots of cases that say if the if the coverage is arguable, if there's arguable coverage, that triggers the duty to defend. So if it triggers means activates, that starts the duty to defend, right? There are lots of cases. But here, they're saying, apparently, in their response, no, it's not arguable, there is no coverage. Is there any case that you can point to that says when they take the position, they being the insurance company, after tender of defense, that there is no coverage, as opposed to arguable coverage, that such a statement, there is no coverage, also triggers the duty to defend?
If I understand Justice Bradley's question correctly, let me try to lay the groundwork for the answer. The issue of whether coverage is fairly debatable is an issue that arises initially, and that is where the Four Corners rule applies.
I understand all of
right.
that.
Right.
You can lay the groundwork if you want, but I'd like you to get to my question. And my question is, and perhaps I wasn't clear enough in my question, we have numerous cases that say the duty to defend is triggered when there is arguable coverage. Here, coverage was denied, essentially taking the position it's not arguable. Is there any case that you can point to that says the duty to defend is triggered when there is an outright denial of coverage? Number one, when there is an outright denial of coverage, but then they go into court nevertheless. Number two. So That's what I'm looking for. I can cite to you all sorts of other cases.
Right.
Is there any case you can cite to?
I don't believe this court has issued a decision that states that if there is an absolute and outright denial of coverage, that that is material to the issue of whether or not there is a duty to defend in the first instance. And so I believe the cases that are closest to what you're asking about don't quite say that, but closely, Olson at paragraph 3, Sustash at paragraph 28, Waterwell at paragraph 16, Talley at paragraph 24, and Reed at paragraph 36 all stand for the proposition that if an insurer wants to bridge and introduce extrinsic evidence to support that proposition, they still will have a duty to defend under the Four Corners rule if indeed coverage is established under that rule.
And indeed, the question that I ask about, can you cite any case that says even when there's an outright denial, there's a duty to defend, kind of that bare bones to me defies reason. I mean, there are cases that are clearly outside of coverage, and why would there ever be a duty to defend?
Well, because that isn't my answer. I'm not saying when someone clearly contests coverage and unambiguously says there is no coverage and we will not defend you, that that is always a losing proposition for the insurer. It can be a losing proposition for the insurer. It's simply a proposition on which the insurer bears the risk of being correct.
Mm-hmm. Counsel, aren't you asking us to overturn what I think is now decades of well-established law in the insurance coverage realm? When I looked at this case, my initial impression was that the insurer did exactly what we said would protect it, and since you invoked the Waterwell decision, I'll start there. We said in that decision, we continue to strongly encourage insurers to follow one of the judicially preferred approaches rather than make a unilateral determination to refuse to defend an insured. So one of the first methods we've suggested as a preferred approach is that an insurer may request a bifurcated trial on the issue of coverage and move to stay all proceedings on liability until a coverage determination is made. Would you concede the insurers, in fact, did that in this case?
I would not.
Right.
They did not request a bifurcated trial on the issue of coverage and move to stay the proceedings?
They did that much, yes. They did request a bifurcated trial and move to stay, and indeed we stipulated that we agreed with that.
Right. So isn't it, in fact, the circuit court's decision that led to this new wrinkle, I suppose you could characterize it as, in the law, because the circuit court did not stay all the proceedings?
That certainly was a unique feature of the case, but the syllogism is incomplete. That is to say, the judicially preferred methods that were cited in your majority opinion in that case, the paragraph that was written specifically states that we encourage people to use these judicially approved or preferred alternatives to unilaterally denying a defense. That is to say, the court's opinion began with the statement that contrasted behavior where a defense is denied from choosing one of the judicially preferred options. In this case, the insurer chose to deny both coverage and defense, and therefore, claiming to avail themselves of one of the alternative judicially preferred options is not faithful to the court's opinion.
So, counsel, is it your position then that the proper procedure here, if they wanted to take advantage of the bifurcation and stay, was to provide a defense from ab initio, file a motion for bifurcation and stay, and then provide a defense until the court tells it that it doesn't have to?
In this particular case, because negligence was pled, coverage was not fairly debatable under a Four Corners analysis, yes, they should have provided a defense while seeking bifurcation and stay.
All right. So as a temporal matter, when does the duty to defend commence?
The duty to defend commences when the claim is tendered, and if the Four Corners rule indicates that coverage is within the realm of the Four Corners rule, liberally construing the complaint in favor of coverage.
Have we ever said anything that suggests that that duty to defend is suspended by the filing of a motion for bifurcation instead?
You have said repeatedly that there are judicially preferred alternatives, and moving to bifurcate and stay is one of those that you have identified. However, you've again contrasted that with a situation where we won't defend or cover you.
So is it your position, then, the proper understanding of what we have said about that procedure is that the filing of the motion does not suspend the duty to defend? It is simply a means of determining whether the insurance company has a continuing duty to defend.
It would be our position that in this case, because of the facts of the case, it would have been appropriate to defend while that motion is pending. And if you want to avail yourself of the retroactivity doctrine, namely making the defense retroactive to the date of tender, then you actually have to do something. You can't simply say we're making it retroactive to the date of tender. You actually have to provide the defense in the first instance, or you have to pay for it on the back end of that transaction. You can't refuse to reimburse the district for what it paid to defend itself and avail yourself of the retroactivity doctrine.
So your position is we don't have to overturn the cases that talk about the preferred methods. We need to clarify that the preferred methods don't negate the requirement of the duty to defend that arises at the time of the tender at the time the claim is tendered.
That is correct. You can expound upon existing authority without modifying or and reach the result that we seek in this case.
Counsel, in response to Justice Kelly's question, you stated, in this case, given the facts, what are the facts that make this apparently somewhat unique? I mean, are you asking for a narrow decision then? Usually when I see, in this case, given the facts, that's a narrower statement of law than a broader statement of law. So.
Indeed. In one sense, the narrow statement, that characterization would be fair. We believe that because coverage was within the four corners rule, that a defense should have been provided, and that set in motion the remaining transactions for the first year case. So indeed, that is a ruling that doesn't require the court to expand greatly upon what it's already said. The broader application, however, is the court has also consistently ruled, and the Waterwell case that we've been discussing is one of those cases, is that the failure to properly defend entitles a party to the damages that naturally flow from the breach, and the court has said that includes fees and costs. In this particular case, we have essentially two very different scenarios that occurred. In the first scenario, the first year of the case, the insurer failed to satisfy its duty, and we believe that the consequence of that is that the district incurred substantial costs and fees, both as to its own defense, but also in terms of the attorneys appearing here, who then had to seek to compel the insurer to do its duty. We think that all naturally flows from the breach, and the court hasn't said that expressly. It said so generally as a matter of principle that consequential damages, if you will, are owing, but it hasn't gone so far as to say that the attorney is seeking to compel the insurer to pay when the insurer refuses to pay is compensable. And our position on that is very clear. It's not unlike a situation involving civil contempt. The insurer has the keys to stop this by paying what is owed for the attorney fees for the defense at any time it wishes. If the insurer puts up a fight over that for 6 years, the result is going to be different than if they make whole when the adjudication is made that coverage and or defense is required.
I also wanted to quote earlier, not that I'm taking notes of what you say, but nevertheless, I say that tongue-in-cheek, quote earlier when you said that the denial was unambiguous and complete, you said. So when there is a denial of both duty to defend and coverage, and yet it is later determined by the court that indeed under the Four Corners rule there is coverage. Are you asking that we, as a matter of law, conclude that coverage must have been at least arguable at the outset?
Indeed, because of the fact that that is when the initial analysis is conducted.
That's why I ask, under these facts,
yes.
I mean, that's what you're kind of pointing to?
That is exactly
response?
Correct. Mm-hmm. You certainly can reach a point where evidentiary hearings are appropriate and perhaps it's proven that coverage is not available and that defense is not available. But the initial analysis is a Four Corners analysis, and it is different than the analysis that might come at some point later. That's the challenge presented, and I use that as a point that I think the court has made repeatedly. That's the challenge that's presented by the insurer's position, is that there never is an accounting for when the Four Corners rule applies at all under their analysis. And instead, it seems that if we simply wait long enough and there's enough discovery done, we can proceed to summary judgment motions without ever accounting for those first months of a case, which in some cases will not have great activity, but in a class action, there will be. And there will be substantial costs and fees incurred in such an action.
What do we do with the fact that here we also have the acceptance of the duty to defend after the motion to stay was denied? And so at that point, there is a reservation, essentially, of rights and acceptance of the duty to defend. So at that point, is the breach, we're no longer looking at the part of the time of the breach? I mean, this is not a situation where they denied it all the way through until coverage was determined, correct?
That's correct.
So what do we do with that? How does that change?
What we do with that, I think, is clear. You have a situation where initially there was a breach, and because there was a breach, damages and or equitable relief should follow from that. When the insurer began to defend the district and began to pay defense counsel to provide that defense on the merits, at that point going forward, I would be the first to tell you that I don't believe at that point the insurer is incurring any additional liability. I would say, however, that the insurer has incurred liability in that first year of the case, and the question for the insurer is, are we going to discharge that liability or continue the fight over whether or not we're going to pay what the insured had to pay its counsel?
Okay, but then the other wrinkle that comes in here is the agreement on fees, which was then made, and we don't have a very clear record, I don't think, of what that was and how that worked, but isn't there an argument to be made that they did, in fact, accept it at that point and that the money that was paid was what was agreed to under this fee agreement?
Not at all, because that fee agreement was not with the district in the first year of the litigation. The district paid the law firm directly. It wasn't party to an insurance contract with the law firm. It isn't capable of getting the fees that the insurance company is capable of negotiating. That is a separate agreement. If you want to control that, the insurer knows exactly how to do it. Provide the defense yourself.
So it was already paid, can't go back. Any kind of agreement between the attorney and the insurance company isn't going to affect you because you're already out the money. Is that what you're saying?
If you refuse to defend and you end up incurring liability because you're paying fees at market rates rather than what the insurer can customarily negotiate with its insurance defense counsel, that is a choice you've made and an obligation that you have to accept at that point, provided, again, that the defense is due and owing, and in this case there's no dispute that it was.
Counsel, aren't you conflating the duty to defend with a breach of the duty to defend? In Elliott, we said an insurer does not breach its contractual duty to defend by denying coverage, where the issue of coverage is fairly debatable, as long as the insurer provides coverage and defense once coverage is established. The insurer, in this case, didn't even wait until coverage was established. They provided a retroactive defense as soon as the circuit court denied the motion to stay.
There are two things wrong with that. One, coverage wasn't fairly debatable under any analysis. This complaint pled negligence. Negligence is covered by the policy. That simply is not the case, and it cannot be ruled that it was, we don't think.
Well, the Circuit Court and the Court of Appeals disagreed with you.
I disagree with the Court of Appeals. I'm not so sure the Circuit Court addressed it directly.
Well, the Circuit Court said there was no breach.
Indeed, but I don't think the Circuit Court at that point was addressing the issue of the Four Corners rule and the issue of whether or not in that first year of litigation defense had not been provided, even though defense had to be provided.
If I understand your argument, you're basically saying that we should create a new rule in Wisconsin that says insurance companies, as soon as a complaint is filed, you better defend or you're going to be on the hook for fees, attorney fees down the road.
The contrary, I'm saying the court should reaffirm an old rule that if you don't provide a defense, you're proceeding at your own risk if the defense has to be provided under a fairly debatable analysis.
So you're basically you would have us remove from our case law all the judicially preferred approaches that we've been telling insurance companies for years that they need to follow.
No, because those judicially preferred approaches are contrasted with a decision by an insurer to unilaterally deny defense. That is to say, the court has stated, we encourage you to consider one of these three or four different alternatives as opposed to denying a defense unilaterally. When you deny a defense unilaterally, these are mutually exclusive options. You can't deny a defense unilaterally and then simply say, but we filed a motion. And for that reason, the denial of the defense and all the substantive consequences of that denial mean nothing because the expedient of filing that motion alone excuses the condition of providing the defense. That isn't the current case law of this court. We're not asking you to create a new rule in arguing as we have. My time is up. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Tom Shrimp. I'm with my colleague Molly Kugler, representing the intervener respondents, Employers Insurance Company of Wausau and Wausau Business Insurance. There is really a single overriding, and the issue is whether the insurers breached their duty to defend the district. Both the trial court and the Court of Appeals, consistent with well-established precedent and the undisputed facts, held that the insurers did not breach their duty to defend. And I don't think we should hide anything here. What the district is asking this court to do is overrule years of precedent and adopt a new rule.
Counsel, let me tell you what's bothering me about this case, and it's really on your side of the line. I know that we've said for years when you look at a Four Corners rule, you can take the step of filing a motion to bifurcate coverage from liability and stay the proceeding, okay? And you file that motion. In my view, that motion only makes sense to the proceeding if it's granted. But your motion was denied because there was not a stay. And my concern is once the motion has been denied and there's no stay, or just making the motion isn't enough. I mean, if you're going to wait, you may end up just where you ended up, with a denial. And so I think, you know, making the motion, I don't think relieves you of your duty to defend. Now, if you're lucky and the court right away grants a stay and things work smoothly, as I think we hoped when we recommended that system, fine. But I think making a motion and then just waiting isn't sufficient. The motion has to be granted to make that process that we laid out really have relevance to what we're trying to do, which is efficiently let the insurer determine whether there's coverage and stay the proceeding so we're not running up a big defense bill, which happened here, with the insured. What do you think about that?
Well, let me make it clear. The insurers didn't just move to stay. They filed the motion to stay almost immediately.
Right.
Before any answer was due.
All right.
The motion was heard by the trial court and argued in September. there was a delay of till December when the court denied the motion to stay. At that point in time, and as the district concedes unilaterally and on its own, the insurers at that point agreed to provide a defense under a reservation of rights. And they also agreed to provide that defense retroactively from the date the lawsuit was tendered to the insurers. So they just didn't.
But you don't think that the price that they paid for that defense was reasonable, I gather, because the insurance company does not want to reimburse the district.
No. We paid, the insurers paid a portion of those fees.
Right.
And they disputed some of the fees over the reasonableness and necessity of those fees.
Right.
And there's nothing in the law, and the case law is fairly clear, that the insurer has the right to question the reasonableness and necessity of the defense fees charged.
I agree.
And that's
was
what
that litigated? Was that litigated in the circuit court? And the circuit court found either that the hourly charge was not reasonable or the number of hours spent were not reasonable?
No, that was never litigated, unfortunately.
Okay, because it seems to me that if that's what you're going to, you know, rest your argument on, that's a determination that would have to be made by the finder of fact, right?
Yeah, and to be clear, it was brought up by the district in motions after verdict after the coverage trial.
Okay.
And the trial court initially affirmed the verdict of the jury finding coverage, which is fine. We're not disputing that issue at this stage.
Yeah.
Thereafter, it was the court reserved the right to rule on the attorney's fees, both the past defense costs that were owed and were the subject of the dispute,
right,
and also the district's coverage fees. When we couldn't reach or resolve that issue, the court then rendered a decision, and only rendered a decision finding that the district was not entitled to its coverage fees. The court never addressed or reached the issue of these past defense costs that were in dispute.
Okay, well, that's what we're here about, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, if you had agreed the fees were fair and reasonable, you would have paid the $80,000, right?
Well, it wasn't $80,000. I think, based upon the record, what was in dispute was about $50,000.
Okay. All right. So you paid part of them, but the full bill was around $80,000.
Yeah, and it's important to note that that wasn't the full. The entire defense cost is in excess of $260,000,
right,
which had been paid.
Right.
And really, there's no dispute with respect to the fees paid from April of 2014 through the merits trial.
Okay.
The district was afforded a full and vigorous defense.
Right. But I think the argument here is that when you didn't provide the defense and waited on the court's decision on the motion to stay, then the district picked up its own defense. The insurance company went back and said at some point in time, okay, we're going to pay for the defense, but what you're asking for that you paid is not reasonable, right?
That's correct, yes.
Okay. So to me, that sounds more like a factual finding than a question of law.
I would agree with that aspect of it.
Okay.
But, and the important part is a disagreement over the reasonableness of fees is not a breach of a defense obligation. That's what the district's arguing in this case.
Okay.
We strongly disagree because it's just a contractual dispute over what's necessary and reasonable.
Okay. And that's kind of what I thought. And so with all the discussion that was going on earlier, I wasn't quite sure, but you agree. Okay. Thank you.
Counsel, at what point did your duty to defend arise?
Well, the duty to defend arises, obviously, when the complaint is tendered to the insurer. The insurer makes an analysis under the Four Corners rule to determine whether or not coverage is fairly debatable or not.
Mm-hmm.
If the insurer, at that point, it can go two routes. The insurer can look at the complaint and say, yes, it's a covered claim, we'll defend, and the case goes on its merry way. The other issue is when the complaint, there's a question of coverage, and the insurer questions whether or not it has a defense obligation. It's at that point that the well-established alternative procedures take effect.
So let me just, before we get there. So if you acknowledge that the duty to defend arises with the tender of the complaint, are you saying that your analysis, the insurance company's analysis, can suspend that duty pending the court's resolution of the coverage issue?
That's correct.
Where do you get that from?
From the history of the case law, starting with the Maori decision back in
yeah.
the 1980s.
So those talk about the ultimate resolution of coverage. But let's take a look at cases like Olson versus Farrar, which suggests this is a continuing duty. Right? So Olson says, Wisconsin policy is clear. If the allegations in the complaint, construed liberally, appear to give rise to coverage, insurers are required to provide a defense until the final resolution of the coverage question by a court.
That's true, but you have to take Olson in context. In that case, the insurers decided to take one of the alternative procedures, that is, defend under a reservation of rights and then seek declaratory judgment.
Okay, what does that have to do with the court's statement that the duty to defend persists until the final resolution of the coverage by a court? It doesn't say anything about what the insurer's decision was, about whether to contest coverage or not. It doesn't say anything about whether the insurer decided to simply deny coverage. It said, if the complaint liberally construed, right, then it begins. The duty to defend begins. And it goes until the final resolution of coverage, right?
And that's the Newhouse case. Going back, the Newhouse case was a case where the insurer actually got a decision from the trial court saying there was no coverage, so they withdrew from the defense. They allowed the trial on the merits to continue while the coverage issue was being appealed. The appeal reversed the coverage decision. And by that time, there was a judgment against the insured.
Right. But what I'm trying to figure out is your position is that filing a motion, your unilateral decision to file a motion, bifurcate, and stay, can suspend the duty to defend. And what I'm suggesting to you is Olson says that duty persists until the court decides the coverage question. So what authority do you have that says the duty to defend is suspended by the filing of that motion?
That's what the Maori case has held. That's what...
Show me the language.
The language?
Yes.
I think we can go to many of the cases. Even in Steadfast versus Greenwich, the 2019 case.
Pick your case. Show me the language.
In Newhouse, states, in Elliott, we clearly stated that the proper procedure for the insurance company to follow when coverage is disputed is to request a bifurcated trial on the issue of coverage and liability and move to stay any proceedings until the issue of coverage is resolved. When this procedure is followed, the insurance company bears no risk of breaching the duty to defend.
Right, but that assumes that you're providing it a defense up through that procedure.
No, it does not.
May I ask a question, Justice Kelly? Are you in the midst of a
no? Go ahead.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's we're getting at what I think is the in my mind precise difficulty with this case. And it was in your response that highlighted it. That is, to an earlier question, you said, well, if there's coverage, if the answer, once it's tendered and you do the four corners, if there's coverage, everyone goes their merry way and the case proceeds. If there is a question about coverage, then there are the preferred methods and Newhouse, you just described that. I think our cases are in tension. In tension. That is, one line of cases, Newhouse, many, you cited several, and several can be cited for the very premise that you advance. If it's questionable, choose one of several preferred methods. And yet, the tension arises with their many cases that we have that say, if it's questionable, right then and there, the duty to defend is triggered. That gives rise to Justice Kelly's question of the suspension. See, these cases, and many of us on this court have written opinions that say the following. The duty to defend is necessarily broader than the duty to indemnify because the duty to defend is triggered by arguable as opposed to actual coverage. So I see those cases all in tension, maybe not contradictory, but in tension, because the departing point from questionable coverage is, oh, choose one of our preferred, or, no, you don't have any choice. It's triggered at that moment that it's arguable. Can you respond to that, please?
Sure. And I think that tension is created primarily in the cases where the insurer outright declined to defend and did nothing. Okay? Under those circumstances, the insurance company is doing that at its peril, because if it turns out the insurance company is wrong, they're going to go back and say the duty to defend was triggered from day one.
Counsel, there are so many cases that have the premise on our court and in the Court of Appeals that I just read to you. I can't tell you if all of the cases have the fact scenario which you suggest, but I can tell you I doubt it.
Okay.
I doubt it, because it is such a widespread premise. So I give that caveat. I haven't read all of them, but I have lots of them in the Court of Appeals and in our court that say that. That's, you know, they start with the concept that we all know, that duty to defend is broader, right?
Yeah.
And then if it's arguable, that's what triggers. Triggers means that's what activates the duty to defend,
but
once it's arguable.
Okay. But under those circumstances, if there's a legitimate dispute between the insurer that feels it doesn't have a duty to defend and the insured who's contesting there is a duty to defend in coverage, a decision has to be made. How can the insurer, under those circumstances, who doesn't want to become obligated to pay defense costs, how they can resolve that issue? And under those circumstances, that is why this court, in its wisdom, has adopted a system that works very well.
I don't think arguable means we can argue about it. I know it might sound like that. But I think there's something to be said that arguable means objectively arguable. Arguable as reviewed by law. Not that I want coverage, you don't have coverage. I mean, that arises all the time when clearly there wouldn't be coverage, but someone's arguing about it. It means whether it's objectively arguable as a matter of law. Do you disagree with that or agree with that?
No, I disagree with that. I think we're getting over semantics in terms of...
Semantics is what we do.
I understand that. And the cases that have talked about determining the duty to defend talks about whether the coverage issue is fairly debatable.
Counsel, I think there's a different way of looking at it, and it goes to Justice Kelly's question about whether the duty to defend is actually suspended. And I'm not sure that the courts have ever phrased it quite the way. The way I look at it is that the duty to defend is triggered by the allegations of the complaint, and it may be there from the inception of the filing of the case, but there's a difference, isn't there, between the duty to defend being there, existing, and a breach of the duty to defend. So we have many, many cases, don't we, where the duty to defend was found to exist, But we have, again, a multitude of cases where the court determined there was nevertheless not a breach of that duty because the insurer followed the preferred approach. Do you agree with the way I've phrased that or not?
Yes, I do. I think you stated excellently.
Thank you.
That's pretty obvious, isn't it?
Well, and the reason I rephrased it is because I think the suspension is, that word suspension was giving the court some pause. But I also wanted to follow up on something opposing counsel said. He's saying to us, well, that doesn't apply here. We shouldn't apply the rule announced in Elliott and perhaps even before Elliott, because here coverage wasn't fairly debatable. So can you give us your argument as to why here coverage was debatable, which therefore might relieve you of duty to or breach of the duty
well,
to defend?
I think the best response, if you comb the record carefully from day one, it's never been contested on the record that coverage wasn't fairly debatable. And if you go through the history of this case, there was two motions for summary judgment. It was never raised in any of those cases that coverage was not fairly debatable. We actually had to have a jury trial to determine at least some of the coverage issues. So there was never any contention that the insurer's position that there was no coverage was either made in bad faith or that coverage was not fairly debatable.
There's no bad faith claim in this case, right?
No bad faith claim whatsoever.
If coverage was fairly debatable, is your opposing counsel correct in stating that at the outset upon the tender of defense that the denial was unambiguous and complete?
Well, the denial letter was clear in terms of that the insurance carrier felt there was no coverage and there was no duty to defend. But it also informed the insured that what it intended to do was follow exactly the procedure it followed, and exactly the procedure that, again, has been sanctioned by this court time and time again.
Okay, and it has been sanctioned, but isn't the issue here that during that period of time, which was a substantial period here because of how long it took to decide the motion, and this was a unique case, it appears, where there was a lot of merits defense going on. What is your obligation during that time? What you're saying to us is it does suspend your obligation because you're arguing that during that time, as long as you file that motion, even if it hasn't been decided, even if there's merits defense still going on, you're not responsible because you filed the motion.
What was actually going on during that time period? There was a motion to dismiss filed. There was no discovery. Motion to dismiss was filed and briefed and argued.
Well, how did they rack up, $80,000? So a class action, isn't there, I've had class actions before. There is kind of a lot going on at the beginning when they're sending out, trying to build the class, and right? Is that some of these expenses we're talking about?
I assume it is. We weren't privy to, obviously, exactly what they were doing behind the scenes.
Okay, so arguably, they're proceeding on merits because there's no determination on the stay. They're having to defend that at whatever cost they pay out to that attorney. Can't get that money back because you later say it was too much. So how come your motion to stay just basically relieves you of the obligation?
I think you have to go back and look at some of the cases. I think the closest case is Kennefic versus Hitchcock, which is a court of appeals decision. In that case, there was a six-month delay between the time the lawsuit was filed and the actual time the insurer moved to bifurcate and stay. And during that period of time, the insured was required to attend depositions, file some motions, things of that nature. And in the Court of Appeals, it was argued that that was a breach of the defense obligation.
They said it was a breach.
That's what was argued to the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals said no. Again, going back to the Maori decision, stating there was no breach of the duty to defend, provided that a defense was provided once coverage was determined. And they added to that that the fact that the insurance company would be liable for retroactive defense fees.
So basically filing that motion, in your position, filing the motion to stay and bifurcate basically suspends your obligation until it's decided.
Until the motion to stay is decided. And that, generally that should be a very short procedural issue. We don't know why the trial court took so long to decide that motion to stay. But number two, as the trial court correctly concluded in its decision, any delay was the fault of the trial court, and it held that the insurance company should not be held responsible for that delay.
So let me, on that point, in returning to my prior point, let me bring you back to Newhouse, the case you cited for your in support of your position. So there, as you say, the court says that when the insurer follows the bifurcate stay procedure, the insurance company, it runs no risk of breaching its duty to defend. But it also said this: however, when coverage is not determined before a liability trial, the insurer must provide a defense for its insured with regard to liability and damages. Right?
Correct.
And essentially, that's what happened here. The trial didn't take place, but there were merits aspects of the defense going on, right, during the time that the court was determining coverage. The import of what Newhouse said is, look, you have to understand, if there is merit stuff going on before coverage, you got to provide a defense. Now, if you do that and you follow the procedure, bifurcate and stay, you won't run the risk of breaching your duty to defend. But if Newhouse seems to say, when coverage is not determined before a liability trial, you have a duty to provide a defense.
Well, we did.
You did not.
We did.
You denied coverage. The whole reason we're here is because the district was paying for its own defense on the merits, right?
Yeah, except the insurance company, once the stay was denied, agreed to provide a defense and agreed to provide it retroactively.
Okay, so let's track down that retroactively bit. Is it your position that if the insurance company refuses to provide a defense when it was supposed to be defending, that it can buy its way out of that breach simply by paying the bills?
Under the circumstances where they follow the correct procedure.
Okay, but that assumes that we agree with you that filing the motion to bifurcate and stay suspends your duty to defend.
I would assume so, yes, if you agree with that. And I think that's the whole purpose of filing for a stay.
Counsel, going back to determine whether these fees were fair and reasonable, whose obligation was it to raise to the circuit court that they were not fair and reasonable, yours or?
Well, in terms of the obligation, like any contract dispute, the district was arguing that it was owed these fees.
Right. I thought the district's argument was that because you weren't defending, and I think after coverage was found, it went to a jury. After coverage was found, then a defense was provided. But the insurance company also went back and acknowledged some obligation for paying for the fees that had been incurred prior to the jury's determination, right?
Well, actually, coverage, the defense was provided well before the coverage trial.
Okay, well, at some point in time, the district was providing its own defense, and then the insurance company decided, for whatever reason, that they should be picking that up, correct?
Yes, after the stay was denied.
After the stay was denied, okay. And my question still remains, whose obligation was it to argue to the circuit court that the fees that the district says they incurred before the insurance company stepped in were not fair and reasonable? Or are they to be presumed fair and reasonable? I mean, who's... To me, this still seems like you're fighting about a factual matter, and I don't know whose obligation it was to raise it to the circuit court.
And it probably was a factual matter. It's like any contract dispute. They were trying to recover X amount of dollars.
Yep.
Get a defense that if they weren't fair and reasonable, that would be the burden of the insurance carrier. And then it would be decided on that issue. But again, that's a simple, contract issue. It's not a breach of the duty to defend.
Right, right. No, I understand what you're saying. Thank you.
But your argument wasn't that they weren't fair and reasonable. Your argument is we don't want to pay it at that price because we made this agreement later with this attorney to accept our price, but that's not what the district paid.
No, the argument was fair and reasonable. It had to do not only with price, but certain aspects of various billing guidelines.
Guidelines that you had with this attorney, correct? But they didn't, at that point, they were on their own. You weren't involved.
Well, for that period of time, that's correct.
So you want to hold them to what you later worked out with the attorney, even though they're already out the money.
Well, the guidelines would go to the fact as whether those fees were fair and reasonable under
Where
the circumstances.
Where would I find anything in the record to indicate what was charged, what was paid, and what the trial court concluded regarding that?
In the record itself, the Court of Appeals decision summarizes fairly succinctly and clearly the nature of what was paid, what was charged, et cetera. In terms of what the trial court determined on that, you would have to go to the decision of the trial court, which is a part of the record.
Are you saying that I can go there and I can find that the district paid X amount in fees and that the court concluded those fees were reasonable?
No. The court never made that determination.
The court asked to make that.
Yes, the court was asked to make that determination.
And when the court didn't make that determination, did someone create a record for appeal regarding the fees, what was paid, and
No.
the reasonableness of them?
No, they did not. The court rendered its decision. A judgment was entered. There was never any effort by the district to come back and seek clarification of that ruling.
And I think that's part of what the chief is asking here. Whose job is it to create that record?
Once again, it was a district that was seeking those fees. Under those circumstances, it would be the district's obligation.
Should this be remanded for a determination on the reasonableness of the fees? I'm not suggesting that it should be, but I want you to address that question.
Okay. My position at this stage is that issue has been waived.
Or forfeited. Two different things.
What?
Waiver and forfeiture are two different things.
I believe waived and probably forfeited as well because, again, it was before the trial court. There was an opportunity to have it addressed for whatever reason. The district decided not to address it or seek clarification from the trial court. Just a couple comments. In terms of the district's claims for attorney's fees for coverage costs under Elliott versus Donahue, we believe the unique circumstances of Elliott versus Donahue do not apply. This court has repeatedly stated that the American rule is what applies in all cases, and that there should only be very narrow exceptions to the American rule. And under the circumstances of this case, my time's up, but the American rule should prevail.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
If I may, there are a couple of clarifications I should make based on the Mr. Shrimp's argument. At the circuit court level, the district did put into evidence an affidavit on what fees had been charged by defense counsel on the merits and how much of those fees had been reimbursed by the insurer to illustrate the gap between what fees had been incurred and what fees had been paid by. I respectfully disagree with the circuit court level. There was never a challenge lodged to the reasonableness of defense counsel's fees. There is nothing in the record or in argument challenging the reasonableness of those fees. There was a counter affidavit at one point that computed the fees differently, but there was no argument that the fees were unreasonable raised with the court. So I want to make sure to make that point with you.
The insurer at the circuit court levels said that it was not paying the full amount of the fees because it didn't believe they were warranted by that part of the action that had proceeded while they were incurred, right?
That's correct. They generally took the position that we are not obligated to pay those fees, but the specific rationale, the attack on the reasonableness of the fees, was not made.
Well, they paid some of the fees, so there obviously was an objection, and there is apparently an affidavit, is there, from the insurance company on what they paid and why?
There's an affidavit from the attorney that provided a defense for the district from Belo Vetter on the fees that were charged by Belo Vetter and how much of those fees had been reimbursed by the insurer.
Okay. Is there a detailed affidavit by the district that sets out the fees that were charged and the services that were provided for those fees?
There is a separate documentation of the fees that were charged by our law firm in pursuing the fees that were incurred by defense counsel. So there is the affidavit for that one-year period when a defense was not provided, detailing the fees that were charged and how much were reimbursed. Then there was separate documentation of the fees incurred by us over the course of the year, seeking to enforce the duty.
Counsel.
Thank you.
Counsel, the Court of Appeals at paragraph 33 figuratively is sighing because it indicates that the district does not provide sufficient proof for us to determine as a matter of law the amount that is owing. It takes the district to task for, it says, whatever agreements that may have been reached between the parties regarding rates and guidelines. That agreement is not in the record. The guidelines are not in the record. The Court of Appeals says that we are left to guess as to the scope, et cetera. I won't continue their sigh. Respond to me why they're wrong and we shouldn't agree with them.
Yes, and with due respect to the majority of the Court of Appeals, I found that part of their decision troubling, frankly. First of all, because there was evidence in the record of, as I said, the fees that had been charged by defense counsel and what had been reimbursed by the insurer, and therefore what the gap was between the amount charged and what had been reimbursed. The notion, however, that the district is even in a position to proffer evidence on what the insurance company's guidelines for the attorneys it commissions, and that it's the district's burden to provide that evidence when the district is not a party to the contract and doesn't have that evidence, as opposed to the insurer who does, I found that, frankly, a misassignment of the burden of proof.
Yeah, but the court could still determine whether the fees are fair and reasonable. Circuit courts do this for all types of cases when fees, attorneys' fees, are requested.
They could, and I would allow for the fact that I don't want to suggest to the court that something that is manifestly unreasonable to the point of being baratry should be approved simply because the insurer failed to meet its duty. That being said, when the insurer doesn't accept its duty to defend and says, you're on your own, the insurer bears a responsibility, as the court has said, at its peril, for what that attorney charges and has to be reimbursed. In fact, in the Kennefec case that the justice asked a question about, there had to be reimbursement made in that case, even where coverage was later established. So it's not a situation where the insurer can simply ex post facto begin a separate debate over whether or not the fees are reasonable. Within the realm of reasonable attorney fees, the insurer bears that burden and takes on that risk.
Well, you are asking for the fees. So usually the person that moves for relief in the circuit court bears at least the initial of going forward with the reasonableness of their request, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Well, I will look at those things in the record. The separate item that you told me about, the additional monies that were expended to try to get the insurer to pay for this early part of the defense. I haven't looked at that, but I will do it, and I appreciate your drawing it to the court's attention.
Thank you. And I should also note that with respect to the fee issue, I'm sorry, My time is up.
Your red light is on. Thank you for a very interesting argument.
Thank you.
And the briefs were well done, too, so thank you so much for that. We're going to take a brief recess now so that counsel for the next case can be seated, and we will be back in just a little bit. We are adjourned.